Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here! And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. And it is 6 p.m. Sunday, February 27th, 2005, according to the clock on the wall at wonderful Studio Al. I'm here with Ravishing Rick, who has rejoined us from his trip to North Carolina. How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing good. Yo, Joe.
I'm pretty good. And Rick had some personal issues to take care of that we won't, you know, unless you want to, we won't get into.
Well, my dad died, but he, you know, it was a good thing. Sometimes people last too long.
Yeah, how old was your dad?
He was going on 84.
Okay, my dad is actually like 85, 86.
Yeah,
and he's had Alzheimer's, and he's, although physically he seems in good health. The last time I saw him, he was still in good health physically. He's just not all there mentally anymore because his memory is.
It was kind of an ironic thing because my father was the dean of a medical school. And he actually helped start a medical school. And the irony of it was that the medicine that he helped perpetuate kept him alive too long.
Well, there you go.
So there's a whole thing out there that maybe modern medicine and technology goes beyond what the ethical limits of what it should be. Or what are the natural limits? What is natural and what, you know, getting back to what the world is.
And how
really
long
like.
Can somebody live? And how long should somebody live? You know, they had that whole thing going on in Florida.
Still going on.
Yeah. And, you know, all those people talk about sanctity of life, and they're trying desperately to keep this woman alive. Now, you know, my own personal point of view, if by some miracle she manages to return to cognitive form, that she's able to recover from that, that would be great. But from what I understand, she had a stroke of some sort, or she had a heart failure that caused permanent brain damage, and that she's essentially a vegetable. Although her parents are saying she's still alive out there, she's still aware of what's going on, she's just unable to do anything about it, and the husband is like, she's been this way for 15 years. And I understand the parents' point of view. But I don't understand it. If the husband doesn't want to be responsible for her anymore, why doesn't he just give guardianship over to the parents and let them worry about the medical bills and all the other stuff that goes on if they want to keep alive? The guy has since remarried. You know, his wife is dead for all intents and purposes. But what if they could keep her body going for long past what would have been her normal life? Should she be kept going?
Well, they've already done that.
But what I mean is, okay, the lady in question is, I think, in her 60s and stuff like that. Can they keep her if they can keep a body artificially going, even after brain functions have pretty much ceased to be, if you can just keep the heart running and keep breathing and you know, even if you have to force feed, keep feeding, if you can do that indefinitely, is that what we want? Do we want to have 200-year-old, you know, corpses, for want of a better term, that have to be constantly fed and made to breathe on their own and all that stuff? Do we want to have that? Is that what you mean by sanctity of life?
Well, I think it's a breeding ground for organ transplants.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can do that with genetic engineering being the way it is, and DNA research. I think we got to the almost can get to the point where we can create new organs from someone's own, you know, cells. You know, and it's not the technology is not there right now, but I think it's heading in that direction.
I don't know, Joe. I've got a message for the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Get the fuck over it.
Mm-hmm.
She's gone 15 years. She ain't coming back. That is the end. Let it go. It's sorry about it, but let it go.
And, of course, it's all political now, too. Jeb Bush is on it because, you know, he wants to police his Christian right supporters. But I'm kind of torn about it. You know, I understand where you're coming from. You know, the lady's a vegetable. She has no brain function. You know, cut the tube. And there have been several times when they've tried to, but they keep getting court orders to stay. And you get the point where there's not going to be anything. So if I was the husband, I'd just say, look, you think she can live, you pay the bills. Because that's a huge expense to keep her alive like that. And, you know, we hear people talk about the sanctity of life stuff. Certainly the Christian right isn't interested in sanctity of life when it comes to bombing the shit out of Iraqis because they have oil that we want. They're certainly all for that. They're certainly not for sanctity of life once the child is already born, but they want it for unborn and they want it for people who are in states like this. You know, my wife and I argue about abortion all the time because, you know, she was almost aborted. And so she's got a very emotional stint to that. But I'm not pro-abortion. I'm just, look, if the decision should be made, it should be, you know, for medical reasons, or the woman should make that decision with the husband and family support, perhaps, but it should be their business and not the government's business. That's the way I see it.
Well, I think the real question is, at what point do morals actually have a right to enter your life?
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what the idea of an abortion has a moral tinge to it, but also the idea of taking a life or stealing or any of those things that are somehow embodied in the Ten Commandments also have a moral tinge to it. So,
I mean, how do you define stealing? So, I mean, is stealing, you know, obviously the obvious stealing when you go into a store and take something that isn't yours, but they're stealing like what the Republicans are trying to do with, you know, getting rid of Social Security. They just want to make it legal for them to steal more money. Like what they did with Enron. You know, what those executives did at Enron was nothing more than stealing. And just because they didn't hold up a liquor store doesn't make their crime any less worse. It really shouldn't make a difference, the money amount. But if you're punishing the crime, that's what you ought to do, right? I mean, these guys should be punished like common criminals.
But so that liquor crime is going to, he's going to go away for 10,
for 10
20,
years.
10 to 20 years.
And these guys would be, you know, it'd be remarkable for us that these guys even go to prison at all.
And how much did he get? A couple hundred at best?
Yeah.
And how much did Martha Stewart get?
Well, Stewart, I don't even know that what Stewart did was a crime. I think she's a political prisoner, personally, because they're going after her mainly because she's a big Democratic supporter. But the amounts of money and what would happen with her is just feeble compared to what Ken Lay and his buddies at Enron did. And they got them on tape talking about how they're going to rob money from Granny, you know.
Absolutely.
But this whole sanctity of life thing, it really, really bugs me. George Carlin had a great bit about that. He said, you know, who says life is sacred? God? If you look back at history, God is the biggest cause of death. You know, do you believe in God? No. Dead. Do you believe in God? Yes. Do you believe in my God? No. Dead. Millions of dead motherfuckers just because they couldn't get the right answer to the God question. And that's, you know, to me it seems rather hypocritical to say you want sanctity of life, but you're unconcerned with the quality of life. And how far do you want to go? Human population is sitting at 6 billion right now. How many people do you want to have on this planet? And let's face cold, hard facts. Each and every one of these people has to have X amount of food, X amount of water, breathable air to survive. And, of course, space, shelter, clothing, these are all necessities for human survival. And how are we going to provide for all of that? And so there's, you know, questions. I mean, people criticize China for their policy of 2 children per family, I think it
one
is.
One child.
One child. But when you look at the population of China and the problems that you have feeding that many people, you could at least understand where they're coming from, even if they're doing it in a rather high-handed manner, which they are. I mean, they're communists after all, right? India has a huge population problem in areas like Bangladesh and other places. I mean, it's really, really bad. And not all of these people have a really decent life. So, who knows? And then, you know, you're not even talking about employment, because, you know, that's another subject altogether. How are these people going to support themselves?
Well, this particular group, as far as I can tell, when they talk about the sanctity of life, it's all about the sanctity of American life.
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do with the rest of the world, except to the degree that we can export that so-called moral value.
But it's about the sanctity of white Christian. I don't want to call him Christian anymore. My wife gets mad at me. We had another big fight over this that I call him Christian. I'll call him Pharisees. We'll call him Christian Pharisees. It's about the Christian Pharisees' right to life. That's what they want. They want to safeguard their own life and their own. It's tribal. It's a tribal thing. And these people, they do all their praying in public. They want to make sure everybody sees them praying. Can't go into a closet. That's what Jesus said, right? Go into a closet if you want to pray. But they got to do it all in public. But what does somebody say? There's horizontal prayer and vertical prayer. And a horizontal prayer is something that's between you and God, and you don't. Or excuse me, a vertical prayer is between you and God. Where you're praying straight up, and you know, you're in the fox. That's when, like, you're in the foxhole. You know, so please, God, get me out of this. That's a vertical prayer. Horizontal prayer is something you do in public for everybody, to see. Yeah. But let's change tack a little bit here, because we were talking about sanctity of life and quality of life, which are two important issues, and employment, because as you know, and as my listeners know, I was laid off at the end of December, and they were expecting to have layoffs in summer, and now I see, and in fact, I got it from the comments section of the board, and everybody out there, again, let everybody know, email me, joevec@bellsouth.net, leave a comment on the blog, cupojoe.blogspot.com. And my old roommate, Donald, not roommate, next-door neighbor. They got some other people living in the apartment next door to us. This is a basement apartment in a house, and there's two of them. And he sent me a note, said, hey, I just read where Siemens is closing their Tucker facility, which I was saying that they were planning on doing when I was working there, because they were talking about layoffs. So, you know, after a while, it's just going to say, is it worth – especially with the Republican administration, it's more to their benefit to just close the plant completely. And where that plant is, that's prime real estate. That's up on La Vista Road by 285. That's some really good real estate over there. But I just looked at the article at the Atlanta Journal-Constipation, that piece of shit newspaper that is in Atlanta. Worst newspaper for any big city I've ever seen, by the way. Absolutely worse. And but they had a little thing in there about how they're closing the place. 445 jobs are going to be lost. You know, I still got my parking tag and my Siemens ID. Maybe I'll go in there and start ragging on some people.
Go to it, Joe.
Maybe I'll just go in there and say, so are you happy now? I'll go to the union president there, Robbie
Sparks. How many of you out there want Joe to go there and rag the Siemens people?
Yeah, right.
Send an email.
Send an email. You want me to go down there and just point. You know what? I won't even do anything really bombastic. I'll just look at them and shake my head. I'll go there to visit some friends to say goodbye before they close the plants up. But I'll just look at all the union people and just shake my head, because they had no power to change anything.
Was that a union plant?
Oh yeah, IBEW, man. IBEW, and it's not a very.
And what did the IBEW do to?
They didn't
protect the workers.
They didn't do shit for me, really. They did a little bit, but.
What did they do?
Well. Basically, they'll help you mediate if there's like a fight or something, not a, like a fist fight, but like an argument or shouting match among the workers, and the bosses get a hold of you and are trying to discipline you. They will help you out as far as getting your discipline set out. But if it's a question of company policy, they really don't have a whole lot of power. Like, the reason why I was let go was because I was late. And absent, not late, really, because when I was there, I was always punctual. I was never late, not never, but no, very rarely, maybe twice over like 2 years, over a year. And but I was absent quite a bit because of my health and because of my wife's health. And I used up all my sick leave, and I used up all the unforgiven absences I was allowed to have. But there were extenuating circumstances. I understand that why they had, they called it a point system. Whenever you missed a day, you got 1 point, and when you got to 8 points, that was it. You were fired.
This is like red marks.
Red marks, basically. A point is a red mark. And when you get to 8 points, you got let go. Now, it used to be 12 points.
Now, did the union agree to this?
Yes, it was part of the contract.
This is part of the contract.
Well, it was part of the, well, I don't know if it was part of the contract, but it was part of the... Because the problem with the union leadership there is that they're still paid by the company. They're not paid by the union. So that's a definite conflict of interest. And it seemed to me that they were more in it for their own... They were more interested in their own position than they were in really doing something to help people out. They will gladly take your $15 a month. But apart from just very small stuff, if there was ever anything serious they needed from you, they couldn't do anything. A lady who I was working with who used to work up in Philadelphia, and she said if the situation... what happened with me, it happened up in her union. Basically, what would have happened is they would have put me on probation. Now, like I was saying, originally, a couple of years ago, according to the people that I talked to that had been there for a while, they said that it was 12 points. And at the beginning of the year, everything reverted back to zero, so you had 12 points. So basically, you can miss 1 day per month, just an unexcused absence in that sense. And, you know, like I said, when you went back to zero.
So when you get an unexcused absence, that's like you just didn't show up.
Right.
You don't call in.
Right.
Nothing.
Well, even if you call in, if it's not a sick thing, even if you let them know, it's still a point.
Well, so if you wanted to take, if you used up all your sick days and vacation days and whatnot, but you need to take Kathy to the doctor.
Right.
And that was a necessity.
Right.
It's an extenuating circumstance,
right.
And you told them the day before,
right,
or 2 weeks before, or whatever.
It's still a point.
The thing, they still have to dock you a point.
Yeah, you don't. You know, obviously, you do not get paid for that day, which I can understand, but you get a point. What we were saying is now the new system was that you got 8 points, and that you get points back, but if you use a point, you have to wait a year to get that point back. So if you take an unexcused absence May 6th, 2004. You don't get that point back until May 6, 2005.
Well, let me ask you, do you get seven? If you get 7 points in 1 year,
mm-hmm.
you haven't reached the maximum yet, but...
No, you don't get more
do
points.
Do those carry over to the next year?
There's no carry over.
This is an erasure policy.
And that was basically what happened with me. Now, I understand why they went down from 12 to 8, because there were a lot of people who were basically taking advantage of that and taking far too much time off. But... And, in fact, I think they got 1 point back a month is what happened, and they reverted to zero at the beginning of the year. But what was happening was, when they went on this new one, they were way too strict on it. They couldn't just go on a case-by-case basis because, you know, the union people there, they know who's working and they know who isn't working. And they can, you know, they can make a case-by-case basis. So they understand what's going on. And it wasn't my case that I was trying to take advantage of the system. I had things that I needed to get taken care of. My wife is very sick. She needs a lot of medical attention, and sometimes I just need to be here with her. Sometimes she was just too sick. She was so sick, I felt I needed to be here for the day just to keep after. It's not like I was doing anything really strenuous. And there were a couple of days, I'm not going to lie, there were a couple of days I just needed a stress day off. You know, I've been doing too much, so I just need a day off. I'm taking a 3-day weekend. And everybody gets those every now and then. And we have this attitude in this country that you work till you die, unfortunately. Too many workers are like that. And they say, you should never take a day off. Even if you're sick, you should go in when you're sick.
We work harder than any nation on earth
any
at the moment.
Earth,
but it used to be, you know, in Japan, they were taught to work like that.
Yeah.
You know, and they'd work 7 days a week until at some point in time, I believe it was the 80s, they finally legislated weekends and vacation into the workers' packages. So
yeah.
These people had to take time off.
Well, they did. Depending on your situation, you did take time off. But because Japan's culture is the way it is, they're a much more homogenous culture. It's all basically, they're all Japanese. There's a few Koreans and a few others living there. They can get away with things and do things that we couldn't even imagine here in the States, and they could do stuff like that. And they also used to have lifetime employment there. If you work for a company, you work for them for life, and that was it. And even if there was nothing for you to do, and there were people whose job it was, they just go there and they'd have a desk and they just sit at their desk all day. and do absolutely nothing. Then they go home. But yeah, they used to have a real workaholic attitude.
So there was nothing the union could do for you?
No. They talked to him, but basically, nope, it's a violation of policy. It's very clear, and that's that. And the best they were able to do was they were able to get it extended because I was going to get let go like 2 weeks before Christmas. But they extended it so that I basically got let go just before Christmas. So I got to spend maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks extra. So they could have done a lot more than that, and they just really weren't concerned with that. And I think they knew they were in a losing position. They had just signed a new 4-year contract. That was another deal. And what I told them before the negotiations, what they ought to say is that if they announced they're closing the plant down completely, because they knew they were shutting down parts of it, there were going to be massive layoffs anyway. They said if they announced that they're shutting the plant completely, they ought to pay the workers that salary at that time through the end of that contract. Pay everybody off the amount of money they would have made if that plant had been opened. And that's what it should have been. But, of course, that never would have gone through. So, and there were a lot of people who refused to join the union because they didn't feel like they were doing enough. Me, I was a union man on principle, even though I fought with the union president. In fact, I had a shouting match with her because I wanted to be a shop steward. And I thought she was kind of farting me off. And I don't like people farting me off. You know, I'm having kind of sort of that. It's not anywhere near as bad, but I have a little problems like that with the decap Democrats when I'm working on the newsletter, because I've been doing layout and the design for like 10 years. Granted, I'm learning a new program, but you always have an eye for design. You know what I mean? You always have an eye for what looks nice on a page. I was born with that talent, and I've been doing. Hell, I was doing desktop publishing before we had desktop publishing, before there were computers. I would do stuff with rub-on letters and just lines drawn on a graph paper and whiteout to correct any screw-ups. And I was putting just bullshit stuff when I was growing up as a teenager in high school, making character sheets for Dungeons and Dragons. But I did really good stuff.
I like the decap Democrats.
Yeah, I like them too. And
they got spirit.
But, you know, they're not, you know, the people who are involved in that are not necessarily creative people. And I get the feeling that sometimes they don't understand where I'm coming from, because they were telling me they wanted the headline to look exactly like it looks on the web page, and you can't do it exactly like it looks like on the web page. What looks nice on computer screen doesn't look good in print. And I said, you know, I told them, I said, look, you're going to have to trust the judgment of some of your people every now and then. Don't micromanage this, you know. But sometimes they were farting me off a little bit. I thought like my suggestions weren't worth stuff, and I'm like, no. This is how it is, you know, and I'm not the only one who's like that. There's two or three other people there who understand where I'm coming from and who are very happy with the work that I'm doing. Everybody's happy with the work that I'm doing, but there was just a couple of people who, you know, they're in charge, but they don't have a creative bone in their body. They're nice people, they're hard workers, but they're not necessarily creative people, and they can't see things in a certain way. We want to put together a newsletter, I certainly do, that people will want to pick up, people will want to read. Not something that's just going to be looked at and tossed out. And a part of that is content, but also part of that is the aesthetics of it. And it was the same way with the union. I would have been a damn good shop steward. I really would have. Because I've got a supervisor's mentality, but like a sergeant's supervisor mentality, not an executive mentality. My focus is always on how can we make things better? How can we do things more efficiently? And people weren't interested in that. They were more interested in their personal power. And the president of the union was like that. The vice president wasn't so much like that. She was much more interested. But there was a whole little clique up there on top that were basically more interested in protecting their jobs than in helping the workers out of the plant. They could have worked out a deal. But they really, in their defense, in this day and age, they didn't have a lot to work with. They really didn't have the union leadership. Because the attitude towards union workers in this country is very, very piss poor, especially down here in the South. People just dislike the union. You know, if you're a union guy, you're a communist, right? You live in Alpharetta. I'm sure you hear that sort of shit all the time, or you see it. I used to hear
the communist thing, but, I think the unions are in the process of redefining themselves. They did very well. They won all the battles. And to be honest with you, they're the ones we can thank for minimum wage.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
we're the
yeah.
Ones we can thank
I understand all
40
that.
40-hour weeks.
No, don't talk to me about that. I understand
things.
That shit, man.
But, somewhere along the line, they got out of control in some fashion, and they allowed the companies to start to take power again.
Their big failing was that they failed in the South. That was their big failing because they could have put more effort and they could have pushed more for union jobs in the South, but they kind of gave up and abandoned it. And that's what really hurt them a lot.
Well, the truth is that manufacturing is a dying economic industry in this country,
right.
And most of the union jobs
or manufacturing jobs.
Or manufacturing jobs. Now, this fellow, I cannot think of his name. I wish I could. Who is head of the hotel workers?
SEIU.
Yeah.
The service industry.
Apparently, is doing some very interesting things.
Yeah. They were big Dean supporters, too, by the way.
Yeah, and they recently had a demonstration here over some of the hotels that were not interested in working with them particularly.
Right.
And they went on strike for one of them. They went on strike with one of the hotel chains. It wasn't Marriott. It wasn't one of those, but it was a big one.
It was a big hotel. Hyatt, maybe.
Yeah. No, it wasn't Hyatt, but it was But anyway, in any case, you know, he seemed to make an impact in starting to make the other union leaders sit up and think a little bit.
Well, there's a big fight between him, and I know who you're talking about. I forget his name, too. Him and the AFL-CIO. And by the way, the IBEW is an affiliate of the AFL-CIO. Actually, so is the SEIU, but they're kind of breaking away and doing more. They're the fastest-growing union in the country. But, yeah, the workers in this country – since the manufacturing jobs are going away, we need to start getting other people, other businesses. And service industry is the big industry now, really, because we're really more of a service economy than anything else instead of the manufacturing middle class base. And, of course, service people make a lot less money than manufacturing people. You know, there were some guys at that Tucker plant that were there for 45 years. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine anybody working at a place for 45 years now starting out a job.
What do they get as a severance from the union? Don't the unions protect them in some fashion?
Yeah, they do get a severance package, but it's based on seniority. If you were there less than 2 years, you got basically a flat rate of $200, and that was it. It wasn't a lot.
And that was you.
And I didn't even get that because I wasn't laid off. I was let go because I was. You see, I would have been laid off at the end of January. And they were planning on some big layoffs. They were figuring they were just going to have a skeleton crew. And they were saying, well, we'll have, because this has happened before, we'll have a skeleton crew here for a while. And then when the business comes back, then they'll rebuild. But now they're closing the plant completely, according to the AJC. And that's like 400-something jobs there, because they had three shifts working.
What do you suppose the state of Georgia would give away or gives away in order to get a plant like Siemens to come here to employ 450 people?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Siemens has been here for a long time. So it's not like they're just coming in. Siemens has had operations here for 50, 60 years. So it's not like they're just walking in the door. But I know what you're saying. And Southern places especially gave away a lot of tax breaks, and they're doing that more recently. A lot of tax breaks for industries, a lot of incentives for them to come down here, you know, plus low wages and no unions and stuff like that. But it basically backfires on the Southern workers in the long run, because sooner or later, what happened in Siemens is going to happen to the other industries. Why should they pay $5.50 an hour? And that's minimum wage, of course. A lot of people make more than that. But why should they pay X amount of money for a worker in the U.S. when they can pay, you know, $66 a week for a guy in Mexico to do the same thing? Even though what they do sucks. And that's what's happening here. The shop is moving their manufacturing base to El Paso, Mexico. Well, El Paso's in Texas, but it's near El Paso. But it's in Mexico. And they'll be paying Mexican wages there, $5, $6 a week, basically.
I recently went to an emporium on Malaysia, which is where my wife is from.
Mm-hmm.
As a trade delegation came to the States, they came up and the trade minister gave a lot, you know, speeches. And then G stood up and gave speeches about Malaysia and all that sort of thing. And it was very interesting to me.
Well, the Malaysian people don't make even as much as $5 a week, don't they?
No. That's not true. You have a misunderstood.
I'm thinking of Thailand and other places, Vietnam. But
well, Malaysia is a – in fact, the trade minister, Rafina, said that If you're interested in low wage jobs and you have a factory or whatever you want to bring to us,
mm-hmm.
we're not interested in you. because that's not the kind of business they want to attract.
Right.
They have done a lot of work to educate their population.
Good for them.
You know, there's almost 100% literacy in the country.
Good for
them. I wish you could say that for here.
It used to be that way.
But in any case, they want to attract the skilled labor jobs and try to, you know, the electronic sector, the service sector in terms of banking, insurance, that kind of thing. So it's kind of interesting to see where some of this is going. In terms of all of this, what do they call it?
Outsourcing?
Outsourcing, yeah.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, and it's going on. I mean, Malaysia is obviously the exception to the rule, but you have places like China and Vietnam and other countries, Thailand, where people do get paid pennies to the hour, pennies to the day, essentially. And those poor Mexican workers, they think they got a good deal going getting their $5 a week. But sooner or later, Siemens and other companies are going to shut down the plants there and move them to these places to produce it for even cheaper.
Well, yeah, that's what happens. Is they just
lowest common denominator.
Sort of goes to, you know, so Malaysia at one stage was a garment worker paradise or cheap electronics and that kind of thing, and gradually they build up their skills
and sooner or later
become too expensive for that kind of thing. That locates somewhere else where it's cheaper, which I guess is the natural order of things.
It's natural
anyway.
Order of things the way the world is today, but eventually you're going to have global labor standards and a global economy so that this shit just simply doesn't happen. If a company wants to move to another facility for efficient reasons, they should be able to do so, but do it for the right reasons. Do it because for a German company to build Mercedes-Benzes and, BMWs in America because it's cheaper to make them there, not because of the labor, but because of the cost of transporting the cars. That's a good thing. Just like it would be good for GM to build plants in Germany so that they can make American-style cars in Europe and in Asia and all like that. That's good for them to do that. But don't do it just simply because you can do it for cheap labor. That's the wrong reason to do that, and we should make sure that they don't do it for those reasons.
Well, on balance, some of that's already happening because GM is in Germany. You wouldn't think of them as GM. You think of them as Opel,
mm-hmm.
right? And Opel actually was the world car, what they declared to be their world car at one stage, and they tried to export it around the world. Do you remember that little Cadillac that was out for kind of a sporty Cadillac? It was out about 5-6 years ago.
I don't remember,
but
I'm not a car
person. I can't remember
what
it was, but it was a little bitty one. That was actually an Opel.
Okay.
With a Cadillac name on it. And they sold that throughout Asia. They sold it in Europe. And Opel is a popular brand over there.
Well, it's a global economy,
but
man.
Owned by GM.
But it's a global
economy.
So how
economy. It's repatriated, I have no idea.
And we need to have global labor standards to go with this global economy. Listen, we gotta take a break here. God, we've been talking for half an hour, man.
Well, good on us.
Backing away.
If you like what we're saying, if you like Joe's show, send him an email. Yeah. Tell him so. Tell him what you think.
Yeah, JOEVEC at bellsouth.net. And the blog, of course, is CUPOJOE.blogspot.com. And tell me what you think about outsourcing and what's the situation with you at work. And I've been out of work for, about 2 months now, honey, right? Which isn't too bad. I'll get a job soon. Don't worry. She's like, you better. Yeah, she's praying.
And while you're at it, Kathy says, tell Joe why you like his show.
Yeah.
Right, and or even if you don't like it, what you don't like, so he can,
no,
he can make it better all the time.
I don't give a shit why they don't like the show. What do you?
Oh, sure you do.
Oh, okay. All right, we'll come back in a little bit. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Tucker Joe Radio Show.
Hi, kids. George Lowe, voice of TV's beloved Space Ghost. You are barking a happy tune with my close personal friend, the lovely Joe Vecchio, on the Cup O' Joe Radio Show.
Looking out over the East River from my jail cell and still running for public office, I realize I have taken several actions in my life for which I owe public apologies. Once I won a supermarket sweepstakes even though my brother's cousin was a box boy in that very store. I would like to apologize to Safeway Food Incorporated and its employees. I would like to apologize to my family who has stood by me, and especially to my wife Karen. A wiser and more loyal spouse could not be found. When I was 21, I smoked marijuana every day for 1 year. I would like to apologize for the next 15 years of anxiety attacks and drug-related phobias, including the feeling that when Ed Sullivan introduced Wayne and Schuster, he was actually signaling my parents that I was high. I would like to apologize to my wife Karen, who still believes in me, and to the Marijuana Growers Association of Napa Valley, and to its affiliates for any embarrassment I may have caused. I would also like to mention a little incident that took place in the Holiday Inn in Ypsilanti, Michigan, during that same time. I was lying in bed in room 342 when I began counting ceiling tiles. Since the room was square, it was an easy computation, taking no longer than the weekend. As Sunday evening rolled around, I began to compute how many imaginary ceiling tiles it would take to cover the walls and floor of my room. When I checked out of the hotel, I flippantly told the clerk that it would take 1,494 imaginary ceiling tiles to fill the entire room. 2 weeks later, while attempting to break the record for consecutive listenings of American Pie, I realized I had included the real tiles in my calculation of imaginary tiles. I should have subtracted them from my total. I would like to apologize to the staff of the Holiday Inn for any inconvenience I may have caused, to the wonderful people at Universal Ceiling Tile, to my wife Karen, and to my two children whose growth is stunted. Several years ago in California, I ate my first clam and said it tasted like a gonad dipped in motor oil. I would like to apologize to Bob and Betty's Clam Fiesta, and especially to Bob, who I found out later only had one testicle. I would like to apologize to the waitress June and her affiliates and the DePaul family dog who suffered the contents of my nauseated stomach. There are several incidents of sexual harassment I would like to apologize for, including: in 1992, I was interviewing one Miss Anna Floyd for a secretarial position when my pants accidentally fell down around my ankles as I was coincidentally saying, "Ever seen one of these before?" Even though I was referring to my new pocket tape memo taker, I would like to apologize to Ms. Floyd for any grief this misunderstanding might have caused her. I would also like to apologize to the pocket tape people, their affiliates, and to my family who has stood by me. I would also like to apologize to International Hardwood Designs, whose floor my pants fell upon. I would especially like to apologize to my wife Karen, whose constant understanding fills me with humility. Once in Hawaii, I had sex with a 102-year-old male turtle. It is hard to argue that it was consensual. I would like to apologize to the turtle, his family, the Kahala Hilton Hotel, and the 100 or so diners at the Hilton's Outdoor Cafe. I would also like to apologize to my loyal wife Karen, who had to endure the subsequent news item in the Also Noted section of the Santa Barbara Woman's Club Weekly. In 1987, I attended a bar mitzvah in Manhattan while wearing white gabardine pants, white patent leather slippers, a blue blazer with gold buttons, and a yachting cap. I would like to apologize to the Jewish people, the State of Israel, my family who has stood by me, and my wife Karen, who has endured my 17 affairs and 3 out-of-wedlock children. I would also like to apologize to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People for referring to its members as colored people. My apology would not be complete if it didn't include my new wife Nancy, who is of a pinkish tint, and our two children, who are white-colored. Finally, I would like to apologize for spontaneously yelling the word savages after losing $6,000 on a roulette spin at the Choctaw Nation Casino and Sportsbook. When I grew up, the usage of this word in our household closely approximated the Hawaiian aloha, and my use of it in the casino was meant to express, "Until we meet again." Now, on with the campaign.
And we're back on the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, voice of the working man, voice of the radical middle, voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, the URL for the site is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. And, of course, I always encourage you to write to me, talk to me, let me know what you think of the show, let me know what you don't think of the show. Just write me. Don't write asking for money. you're not going to get it. In fact, I need money from you. If you want to donate something, go to the blog and click on the Make a Donation button. $10, $20, whatever you can afford. You don't have to. Don't spend the rent money. But if you got a couple of extra dollars, throw it in the till there, because now I got to pay Ravishing Rick as well as all my other expenses. Rick demands money for his participation. What did I pay you, a quarter last week?
I am damn expensive.
You're damn expensive. More than a quarter. Two quarters, ladies and gentlemen. Four bits. Four bits for Rick. And that was Steve Martin, by the way, a public apology from the album Drivel. And Martin is one of the funniest guys. But, you know, Martin is kind of an elitist, though. You know, he used to do all that dumb stuff early in his career just to see what stupid stuff he could get away with. Really, I'm serious. He really doesn't have a lot of respect for his audience.
But he was perfect for the 70s.
He was great. He's made some great movies. Roxanne, L.A. Story. Those are some of the best movies ever made, really. Some of the funniest movies ever made. He's done some great, great stuff. He's done some crappy stuff, too. Sergeant Bilko. Oh, my God. That was an awful movie. But anyway. Hey, you know, both Rick and I are involved in politics. You're with the North Fulton Democrats, and I am with the DeKalb County Democrats. Fulton County is actually really Fulton County. You can separate into two areas because you have the northern part, which is up in Alpharetta, Roswell, stuff like that. Very rich, very wealthy, fairly conservative. And then you have downtown Atlanta, which is very minority, very liberal. And the two don't necessarily like each other. There's a lot of people up in Alpharetta and other places that want to secede from Fulton County, and they have an older county. What was the name of that county? There has been talk. What was the name of that county that used to be there? They used to have a county.
I have no idea.
But they're talking about reforming that county, and a lot of it is racist in base. But we're both fairly active.
Actually, let's not say racist. Let's say it's money-based.
It's money-based.
It's have versus have-nots.
Yeah, but the haves are the whites and the have-nots are the blacks. Which makes you racist, I guess, but still. It's the same way with MARTA, man. They don't want MARTA because they don't want the brothers coming up there. You know, they don't want the wrong element coming to their neighborhoods. If you could figure out a way to get all white MARTA, they'd ride it a lot more. I guarantee
that could be. That could be. That's, when you talk about the browning of America, we talk about the last hurrah of the white man.
Well, we'll see.
With this administration trying to take us back 50 years.
Well, you know, the one thing about white people, and I shouldn't say this being a white person myself, but the one thing that the white people excel at is killing people and taking their land and taking their money or stealing money. And they're very good at getting power. So we got to give them props for that. You got to give the white people props for that because they have excelled. European white Christian Pharisee, and I'll add that term on so my wife understands what I'm talking about. The Christian Pharisee Europeans have been very good over the centuries at taking land from other people and taking money from other people and exploiting or otherwise just doing that shit to people.
And now what are they taking, Joe?
They're taking
our votes away. You know, and they don't like the hardcore Republicans, the neocons, the new royalists like Bush and Cheney and all that. They have absolutely no love for the democratic process at all. They are not interested in the will of the people, despite all their high-sounding words and all the bullshit that they tread out to the idiots in the general public who fall for it. They have absolutely no belief in that. And in Georgia, we're at the forefront of it because Georgia is only one of two states in the union that has completely paperless voting. Everything is done electronically. And the person most responsible for that is the Georgia Secretary of State, Kathy Cox, who is a Democrat, but she's a fairly conservative Democrat, almost a Zell Miller Democrat. Not quite, but close. Not quite as fanatical as she is, but as he is. I describe her more as middle of the road. Zell, you don't know where he stood. You
well,
know?
Zell was different one when time he was
he's holding. Well, one time he's holding the axe handles for
Lester Maddox,
and the next thing you know, he's doing the Hope Scholarship for kids. And then the next thing you know, he's back with axe handles in the Senate. You know,
John Kerry's going to be shooting spitballs at Saddam
shooting
Hussein.
Spitballs and if you're out there, Zell, we would like to challenge you to a duel.
I'll give you it's paper clips and rubber bands at dawn.
I'm ready to kick your ass. Anyway,
I said Kathy.
I met her a few times. I'd say she's a middle of the road Democrat, but she is very, very strong about this Diebold stuff, even to the point of having done some kind of endorsement on the Diebold website.
She is. she has staked a lot of her political career on this because she is primarily responsible for making Georgia paperless voting. And we had a town hall meeting. It was run by Representative Stuckey, who is my representative here in state, District 85, where I live. She's my representative. She had a town hall meeting at the DeKalb County Library, the main branch. Beautiful library, by the way. Great meeting facilities, like auditorium style downstairs. And DeKalb County is like very liberal part of Atlanta. It's a very liberal part. It's just east of Atlanta, and Decatur is like the main city of DeKalb County. And it's very beautiful down there. Very nice little downtown section. Very historical. A lot of famous Civil War battles. Well, it's like all over the South, but in Decatur's case, there were several important battles that took place there before the burning of Atlanta. Now, at any rate, Kathy Cox, who was apparently a friend of Representative Stuckey, Barronfield, is a friend of hers. She was invited to speak at this. Now, I belong to a group of people who are working on election reform. Actually, a couple of groups. One who is doing an audit of the entire vote, and another one who is doing a legislative approach. And what the legislative people want is they want some very basic, very simple things. They want the paper ballot to be the official ballot of record. They want a paper ballot to be the official ballot of record. They want the votes counted by hand in public at the polling places when the polls close, at each precinct, counting at the precinct level. And they want to have a constant chain of custody for the ballots. So they're always in public view while the voting process is going on, and so that everything there is held very accountable. So that if you're going to have fraud, you're going to have to make it so obvious, and you're going to have to spread it out so far and wide that it just makes it a lot more difficult to do it. There are other issues in voting, disenfranchisement, you know, the long lines at the voting machines. Those are all very and equally important issues too, but the group that I'm with, the legislative group, is dealing with these issues specifically. They're not trying to downplay the other issues, but that's what they're dealing with. And a couple of them have been activists for a few years, and I don't want to say they're following Kathy Cox, but they have been one of the most visibly critical of her. And one of them, a lady by the name of Ginny Howard, who is very recognizable because she's got really deep red, very copper red hair, very clear, very obvious. And so they all went to the meeting, and they had
You go ding, 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 like the battery that comes.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. We'll find if we have that sound effect, you will have heard it.
The Duracell.
But yeah, she was, and Kathy Cox had heard that we were going to be there. Now, I was there as an official representative of the DeKalb County Democratic Party, and I told him, I said, look, don't make me ask any questions, don't make me do anything, because I like being part of the DeKalb Democrats, and not everybody in the DeKalb County Democrat is a big Kathy Cox fan. There's a lot of Democrats who aren't necessarily fans of her because of this issue. This is an important issue that's kind of simmering right underneath the surface, you know, because there's a lot of people who are aware of it, but they don't want to speak out publicly. But there's a lot of anger underneath.
You haven't added the extra to this. What is the extra bit about Kathy Cox? The extra bit about Kathy Cox here is she's going to run for governor.
She's going to run for governor
in 2 years' time.
Right. That's the big thing, and she's placed so much political capital on these Diebold machines, and we really don't know why. We don't know if Diebold has something on her or if she signed a deal with Diebold of some sort. We don't know what's going on in her head. I can't make that kind of comment. But we know that she is sticking by Diebold talking points. And at this meeting, I was told what talking points to expect from her. And sure enough, that's what she gave us. And the main talking points were, one, that Georgia was one of the most accurate voting procedures in the country. According to a study from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which in my eyes is bullshit, because if you don't have any paper evidence, how do you know how accurate it was?
Well, certainly we don't have any evidence. Well, maybe she does.
Well,
but she's not sharing that, is she?
Once you cast your ballot in these Diebold machines, You don't know what happens to it.
No, no, no. What, no, tell me what she's doing. You're trying to find out. Your group is trying to find out, county by county.
What the other group is doing is they're trying to see, A, if there was fraud, and the people who are, the lady who's in charge of it, named by Phyllis Huster, she is trying to see if there was actual fraud in the election. So what she's doing is she's conducting a statewide audit. And I'm trying to keep this as quick as I can because we only got about 3 minutes or so to talk about it left before the show ends. But she's doing an entire audit, and we basically got the receipts. Now, at the end of the day, these Diabol machines produce a receipt as to how many votes were cast and who they were vote for. They don't print an individual ballot, but they do print a receipt out. But that's not what gets counted. What gets counted gets sent transferred automatically by modem into a main server, and that's what gets the official count. It's done electronically, it's done very quickly, and it can be very easily intercepted and changed. So what they're trying to see if the fraud was at the machine level or if the fraud was in the transfer. So what we're doing is we're conducting an audit county by county, and there are 159 counties in Georgia, of all the machines, of all the count, and comparing it to the official printed results that are available on some of the websites are available through Freedom of Information Act. In some counties, it's right on the website, the PDF as a PDF or an HTML file. Okay? That's the background on that. And we had Kathy Cox at this meeting, and they were intending to do something. My election reform group was intending on doing something, and Kathy Cox tried to preempt us by saying, oh, we're going to have some entertainment here. We might have some entertainment. But what happened, what wound up happening, was that she got slammed by Richard Searcy, who was representing Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. And Cox was not prepared for that. She wasn't expecting that. And it caught her off guard. And she kind of and she tried to do all the usual, the straw man argument. She kept saying how fraudulent the optical scan voting was. But I don't know how many counties in Georgia did optical scanning. And that's not what we're talking about anyway. This is such a huge issue for so many of us. Count the friggin' votes by hand. In fact, Kathy Cox, I don't know if she realized it, but she made one of our points for us. She was talking about the vote in Washington State, where the initial count had the Republican winning by a very small margin. They did a recount that showed the Republican winning by an even smaller margin, and then they did a hand count which confirmed that the Democrat had actually won the governorship. And the Republicans eventually gave up on it after filing a few lawsuits and trying to get everything reversed again. But because there was such clamor about it in the state of Washington, we have a Democratic governor in Washington State.
Yeah, but you told me something interesting.
Keep it quick, man.
Something interesting that I didn't know before. Actually, each machine, each Diabol machine, has within it the power to print something. So it is possible to print an individual ticket or receipt of your vote,
right. We don't
possibly
like
with some receipt. Possibly with some software modification, right?
And
that could be used to become that ballot.
You could use that as the ballot. We don't like to use the word receipt. The word receipt implies that it's something you take out, and you do not want that. You want to have a secret ballot.
Well, yeah, I understand, but the issue here is: do you have something that is a tangible record, not an electronic record, but a tangible record you can compare and contrast with.
Okay, and at that, we really have to stop because we're out of time. Rick, I want to thank you for the show. And again, tell me about what you think on this issue. Write me, cupojoe.blogspot.com is the blog, joevec@bellsouth.net. For Ravishing Rick, for my wife Kathy, and for all of my listeners out there, this is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show saying goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Joe, I crave a plate of Dave. Open a jar of John. Don't put anything on. I'll chug a jug of George. I'll sip a mug of Doug with a creamer of Steve. How many more does that leave? You'd be a pot of Scott. Heat up a pan of Stan. Throw in a handful of Dick. That'll do every trick. Open a can of Dan. Make a meal of Sam. But don't give me no mug, cause what I really want's a cup of Joe.
The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been recorded live at the fabulous Studio Al in Decatur, Georgia, and has been produced by Jove Enterprises, Incorporated. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is a production of Mr. and Mrs. Vecchio of Brooklyn, New York.
A plate of Dave, creamer of Steve, a mug of Doug, a cup of...